I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Sleep past, you're all good? If I sleep to 8 o'clock, I have a one-year-old, so that's rest for me now. Like, it's been great.
And welcome to the final Heritage Radio Network live podcast panel here at South Bites at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. We are really, really excited for this one. Couldn't be a stronger panel to close with. My name is Jack Inslee, the executive producer of the network, joined by one half of the Snacky Tunes massive, Darren Bresnitz.
I don't know if I call it massive. Sorry, I was eating a cold breakfast taco.
Sounds like Snacky Tunes. That's the way to go. Sounds like a regular episode of Snacky Tunes.
I mean,
Instead of pizza.
I mean, no one does breakfast tacos like Austin. There's just no way around it. Or at least the ones in my mind that scratch the itch. But I wanted to introduce two amazing chefs, Alex Dupac, Eric Berner Yang. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
What's
Thanks
up?
For having us. Thanks for having us.
Quick intro, who you guys are. Why don't you say it yourself? I always like to hear how people describe themselves.
Yeah.
Alex, how do you see yourself?
How's it going? My name's Alex Dupac. I'm the chef and owner of Empeon Restaurants in New York City. And I'm more or less a taco salesman at this point.
Just peddling your taco wares.
That's what it comes down to.
And cookbook author?
Yeah. I wrote a book. That, incidentally, was also about tacos. And
Shout out to Jordana Rothman.
Yes, mm-hmm. Jordana Rothman did an incredible job helping me write it, and I'm really proud of it.
And a couple of award nods as well, or nominations.
Yeah, so far so good. We got 3 nominations, the IACP Awards, so fingers crossed, maybe we'll get one.
Yeah. I believe that you will. I believe in the power. It's a great book.
Thank you.
Eric?
My name is Eric Berner Yang. I'm the chef owner of Toki Underground and Maketo in Washington, D.C.
How is the D.C. food scene?
Different, you know? It's a small city, rapidly growing. I feel like I'm saying in haiku. Small city, rapidly growing, due to Obama. There you go.
There it is.
Almost,
wow.
almost haiku there.
Nice. Yeah. Well done.
Thanks.
Get some like finger snaps going. So what we want to talk to today is really just about like the shifting perception of what food costs. And not just from like
real costs.
The real cost, like not just from a fast food perspective, but like in doing foods that are once considered cheap now being elevated. And why they cost so much and what people sort of have an issue with. You know, or trying to re-educate them. Now, Alex, I know that you have become like a taco ambassador of New York, but your tacos, for those who don't know, explain like what type your approach to tacos, and how they are elevated above the like maybe your like $1 carne asada street taco.
Yeah, sure. So we focus on Mexican cuisine, and we try to be inspired by it, and we use the taco honestly as a tool or a portal. Or a way to start a discussion about Mexican cooking in general and what it's worth. We still feel very much that there's a lot of bias towards it and many other cuisines that we sadly think of as immigrant class in America. So what we're trying to do is use a taco to actually create true price diversity within a genre of cooking. So we have one place, Empeon Al Pastor, which is our cheapest, and most of the tacos on the menu there are $4, and that's still annoyingly expensive to people. Some people understand why it's a bit more, because we, you know, import our own corn from Oaxaca, and we grind it and nixtamalize it ourselves, and those things take work. Arguably, it takes more work than making fresh pasta in-house, which people are happy to pay $24 for.
Sure.
But then we also have Empeon Taqueria and Empeon Cocina. So, yeah, for us, it's just really about sort of creating this price diversity, which we feel like the cuisine deserves. When you look at Italian or French, they certainly have achieved that. So we think Mexican could do the same.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, when I think about mole, it's like 40 ingredients, 50 ingredients, 60 ingredients, and then it's like, that's just a ton of stuff. You know, tomato sauce could be easily tomatoes, salt,
Sure, and that's not to make an argument that it's more complex than other cuisines. It's just that it's
no. But I'm saying there's more that goes into like it's. I mean, it's you never think of Mexican food and go, well, that's a bland, non-complex.
No, 100%. And I mean, I've said this statement over and over, and it's pretty unpopular, but I'll always argue that some of the greatest lovers of Mexican cooking are the ones that are keeping it in the economic ghetto. So the ones who are saying, well, this is bullshit, and I know where to get the best $1 taco, they're not really thinking about the quality of life of that person making the $1 taco. Is that taquero sending their kids to college? Are they buying good ingredients?
Right.
Or so sometimes I think the quote-unquote fans or lovers of it are obviously the problem.
I mean, but how do you... Well, we'll get into how that shifts in a
sure.
second. Sure. But Eric, I mean, talk about the food that you make and the difference approach to your cuisine.
So Tokyo Underground is kind of a modern take on Taiwanese American food. It's specializing in ramen. I am not Japanese, so we don't say it's Japanese ramen specifically because of that, even though there's the backbones in that cooking. And then at Makedo, we do Taiwanese Cambodian food in the way that I know it, which is just through, you know, my life experiences through those cultures. One, my wife being Cambodian, and then obviously
sure.
me being Taiwanese. You know, kind of in regards to what, you know, Chef was saying, you know, we cook immigrant food, but we cook it here in America. And those will always, because we do those things, you know, our barriers are always price first. What?
Right.
How do we price it on the menu? And at what degree and what level do we want to do it at? And then once we figure out what that final price is, you know, there's always a constant conversation about justification. And how do we justify? How do I justify serving a $15 bowl of ramen? And then you get, you know, XYZ person that they're always saying, you know, well, you know, it's $5 in Japan, or you know, this is $2 in Taiwan, or this is $1 in Cambodia.
They understand currency conversion rates, though, right?
You probably not.
Probably not.
You know?
Probably not.
You know, like, I was teaching English in Japan, and, you know, I never spent more than $20 a month on food, and it's like, well, you know, this is not reality, you know?
Right. So here's my question. So we all know the conversation is that you take ethnic food, you put it at quality ingredients, you put do that, it costs more. But what's the argument? I mean, where does the conversation go instead of this sort of like infinity loop of like, we use better ingredients, we do more things from scratch, things like that? Like, what can you say now? Like, what is the deepest, darkest new argument that you have to make people really open their eyes and see like why there is a cost for this type of food?
I'll answer that first because I've actually been thinking about this. Mostly also because I'm just a huge fan of Chef here, where, you know, arguably one of the greatest pastry chefs of all time, especially like second newer generation, who takes this venture into kind of breaking this barrier of tackling, you know, Mexican food and doing it at a really high level. But the way I want to answer that, it actually takes someone like him to break those boundaries for the next ethnic chef to come to pave the way. So basically what I'm saying is it's going to take someone not of that ethnicity's either cultural background or color background or anything like that. They are typically the ones that kind of pave the way that allow someone like me to kind of follow in those footsteps and say, well, you know, he's doing it, and you guys all love that, and it makes sense to you that he's doing it. So, you know, now we're our generation of our group of people are going to do that. And I think you'll start seeing a lot more of that, you know, new wave Mexican food or new wave Asian food, where people like Alex are the ones that were able to break that kind of ground for us. Rick Bayless is another perfect
sure.
example.
Well, my approach to the whole thing is I've actually kind of, other than like having the opportunity to write a book or have an interesting conversation with people like yourselves, I actually don't think there's anything to say or do. I think, or excuse me, not say but do. Like I think that it's all about actions. So we can get really down on ourselves. I mean, hell, I read a Yelp review about one of my places today. I still read them all and torture myself. Where they were pissed off that they spent $10 at Empeón Al Pastor, and it broke their heart that it was so expensive for Mexican cuisine.
Broke their heart.
Wow. know. At the end of the day, you have to look, as a restaurateur, I'm going to look at my places objectively and go, are we doing a good job?
Sure.
Sooner or later, you also have to acquiesce to the idea that this is not a moral issue and that business is risk. And you have to be willing to put something out there, and you actually have to be willing to fail. If all three Empeones closed tomorrow, that the world would go on. I would have a hard time living with that, but the world will be just fine. My approach going forward is to keep opening more restaurants. I'm going to grow. So if right now 70% of the New York City population is accepting me and the other 30% isn't, I'm going to keep drowning them out.
Oh, I mean, that's a pretty good percentage of New York public liking you, 70%.
Sure, sure. And I mean, I don't even have any way to quantify that.
No, you've gone on the record now, and this is now forever.
Okay. It's 70.
70%.
Yeah, 70% of all of New York thinks I'm the shit. sure. No, our approach, and again, to tie this more into, forget about the cost of ethnic cooking or the perception of it, just the cost of restaurants. Some people, like, look, you can look at it negatively and sit, like, honestly go, like, I see a dark patch coming in the New York City restaurant or just the restaurant world. Or you can just think about it as revolution and radicalization. I mean, think about this idea. I mean, once upon a time, everyone here bought all their music in a record store.
Right.
And we liked that experience very
sure.
much. And then something else became available. Right. And we as a culture made a choice. Now, record stores still exist, but there's way, way less of them. And all the big chains are pretty much shut or shutting. We decided, without saying a word, that we were okay with not having the experience of, you know, thumbing through the CDs, buying it, you know, pulling that plastic off the jewel case. Like, we said, we're okay with that. We said we don't need the packaging. We just need the stuff. And I actually see that starting to happen now with restaurants.
Yeah.
And it might piss off a restaurateur, but you also have to look at it objectively. Let's talk about some facts. I mean, in New York City, I mean, I can't speak to other cities. New York City costs are going up. The minimum wage for tip earners just went up this year. And for Empeone alone, that meant $350,000 just lit on fire, gone, that you are now no longer making.
Yeah,
so,
but your employees then make more money.
Sure. Sure, right. But that cost is just completely transferred to the restaurant, and the restaurant somehow has to figure out how they're going to stay open.
Right, you can't raise your prices to really match.
Well, you can do whatever you want, but now here's the other part of that: people in general are not making more money. So with those tip earners making, it's not like, well, everyone in every other business is just making 2 to 10% more money. It just didn't happen, and it's not going to happen. So there's other – rent continues to climb. Cost of food continues to climb. So objectively, as a diner, if I know that like a cheap meal in New York City is now going to be $120 for two people, and it's a 50-50 crapshoot whether I'm going to get a shit table or a good table or a shit server or a good server, why wouldn't I buy a bottle of wine and order it on Maple or go to the grocery store,
yeah,
cook it myself, and watch Netflix? Why wouldn't I do that on my Saturday instead of – so – I think you're going to see, like, back to, like, there's food's not going to go away. I think creative chefs are going to, like, come up with new ways to deploy it.
I mean, you have a beautiful restaurant. You have a fun experience. You know, you go out. But do you care if someone eats your food in the restaurant or in their apartment?
I mean, I care that I still have my restaurants.
Of course.
Empeone, I think, will ultimately be okay because we have infrastructure. I've leaned into growing and turning us into a real restaurant group. And I'm doing that so you have, look, if you have four restaurants with 300 employees, you have better insurance rates than if you have one restaurant with 15 employees.
But, I mean, that's, and I think we talked about it before, but, I mean, having more restaurants, being a restaurant group, seems like the only way that you can really keep your costs down and really survive.
Maybe, and it's sad. Like, look, it's like I applaud Danny Meyer for getting rid of tipping, but Danny Meyer also has a huge company,
yeah,
and he has culture coaches, yeah, and CEOs and CFOs and COOs and every
and
other
Shake Shack.
Every other thing that you can think of. So he has infrastructure to do that.
Sure.
My worry, particularly with New York, like my New York and what I love about New York, I'm afraid of a certain artistic element, a certain... I mean, like, look, since I've been in Austin, it's been incredibly inspiring. Some of the businesses and the way they're put together and the uniqueness of them, you would spend $4 million with a designer to make things look as fucked up and as unique as I'm seeing them here. and I sadly am starting to see that get whitewashed and gentrified out of New York City.
Unless you go to, like, it's like Brooks's place, like Superiority Burger, where you're getting a tiny shoebox that feels fresh and unique, but it's like a hole in the wall.
Right, and you know, Brooks is a very courageous person,
yeah,
but like we need, I need 20 more like him in that city, and it's going away. Like the East Village, if that was the last seedy neighborhood, or if the Lower East Side or Chinatown, I mean, what happens when they start tearing down buildings and opening up an Abercrombie and Fitch there?
So what about D.C.? Because, I mean, I know that we focus a lot on New York and things like that, but, like, in another, I mean, D.C. is a big city, East Coast. Is it comparable or is it different?
I mean, kind of to piggyback on that, you know, New York City used to be kind of like the cultural reference point of anything interesting that was going on anywhere in, you know, in America in general, if you wanted to see the best band, go to the best restaurant, go to the best retail stores, and it, you know, slowly those things are kind of going away, and people are opening their flagships in different cities that are just more viable. DC is not a, it's actually a really small city, maybe like 8 miles left to right. And it's still really new. You know, we would go to the same restaurant for prom and homecoming in the city because it'd be the only like
shout it out.
Yeah, the Red Sage,
there
you know.
You there you go.
And it was like, which is now Jose Andres' OML. And, you know, there were only maybe like half a dozen decent restaurants in Washington, D.C., but now you have this huge explosion. But I think, are we carving an identity? Probably not. And we're probably 10 years away or so from that, where we can have anchor chefs who have large anchor businesses, 4 or 5 restaurants, self-made guys doing restaurant groups, you know, however they want to think of a new way to call a restaurant group. But all of those things are necessary. Whether you have 10 restaurants doing 2.5 million, you got a 20 million portfolio, or you got 3 restaurants doing 10 and 10.5 million, which is per typical, say, like the New York restaurant groups, you know, those are their average numbers. You kind of need those things because you need leverage, you know? You need to spread the costs throughout all of your businesses. You're required by law to follow all of these HR rules that didn't exist for restaurants before that you now have to do. In DC alone, we have to do health insurance, you know, increased minimum wages, public transportation stipends, maternity leave. I mean, these are all things that people should have anyways, but we just never had to address them in the restaurant industry. And the only real guys that are willing to open restaurants are guys that are 25 to 35 who want to do new cool things. And these are massive barriers. But we, it's like, you know, originally you just want to open a restaurant or a bar, have your friends come hang out and, like, you know, do whatever it is you can to survive. But now there's just so many rules and regulations that it's like, fuck, maybe I'll just go work for Alex instead. It just seems way easier. And that's where, not to discount the work that we do, but you're just going to get less and less guys really willing to kind of like take these huge risks to do interesting things.
Are they having the tipping conversation? Are you hearing that in D.C. at all?
There's a few restaurants that do it. I'll shout it out because my daughter plays with their sons, Sally's middle name. They do the no tipping there, and they, you know, I feel bad for them because it's really just like a husband and wife running a restaurant kind of thrown into this huge thing there, and I don't think they were really ready to answer really hard questions about wages, but they do it, and it's definitely been challenging for them on a consistency level. It's been hard for them, but I think, you know, all of that is hard, whether or not you're talking about, like, do you know how to fix a toilet when you open a restaurant on a Friday night and get it done without freaking out. These are just things that you learn to adapt to, and you figure out how to, like, move through them.
So do you see, with this increased cost in these major cities, D.C., New York, do you see a talent drain going to other cities? And do you see, I mean, you said about Austin, but even Austin unto itself has got, you know, increased prices and things like that. Like, are people going to, I don't know, Minneapolis, Nashville, even cities that are not buzzword names yet because they're like, I want to open up a restaurant. I don't care where I am because social media means I'm everywhere.
Yeah.
And I'm willing just to get out of New York.
Sure. Yeah, you're seeing a few things happening. So one is what you just said. So once upon a time, before social media, you actually had to get on a friggin' plane and go somewhere to eat that dish. I had to go travel to eat a biscuit coulant or a gargouille from Michel Bras. I had to go to El Bulli. Whereas now you're seeing less of that because of social media, which I think is a little sad. And I feel like you're seeing, not to sound bitter or old or anything, but you are seeing a younger generation, which is much more entrepreneurial at a young age, which I think is great. But I also think that qualitatively, what we're doing to the industry is quite negative. So, look, I think that the industry correcting itself, well, there should be maternity leave, and there should be a living wage, and there should be all these things, 100%. But also another thing I'm seeing is that I'm not seeing a character in line cooks anymore. When my first job out of culinary school, I got paid $80 a day, which is factually illegal, but I did it. So whether I worked 8 hours, 12 hours, 16 hours, it was always about between 12 and 16,
yeah, I was gonna say.
I got $80 a day. And that $80 a day meant 5 days a week, 400 a week. So if I worked a sixth day or a seventh day, I still got $400 a week before taxes. But I remember not even thinking about money back then. Whereas now what you're seeing in New York City is you're seeing young people come to you who, one, can't hold a knife, and two, are also in a position to negotiate. That's an interesting thing that's happening.
What are they negotiating? Like, huh? Someone else is willing to pay me more? Like, what's
They're like, oh, well, I can get $16 an hour elsewhere. And I'm like, $16 an hour? Like, it's...
Yeah, you're insane.
It's... But they're saying that because they can get it, and they're right. So you're seeing that. And yes, you're seeing another thing, too, which is that once upon a time, if you were a serious cook, you had two... In America, you had two choices. You could go to New York City, or you could go to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, there are factually awesome, serious... I mean, look, there are not as many awesome restaurants in Nashville as there are in New York City. I'm sorry, that's not a knock. We just have more restaurants. We just have more.
Hold on, but when you say awesome, like what is... Like
when I say... When I mean a serious cook or a serious chef at the helm with a point of view, but they are there. So yeah, if you're going to get paid, say, $15 an hour and work a 40-hour week and get $600... a week right out of culinary school, you actually probably can get an apartment for that in Nashville.
Yeah. In those secondary and tertiary markets.
Whereas in New York City, you're that's poverty. So there is something broken there, and that is why you're seeing really cool restaurants open up in Minneapolis and in Nashville. And I think Detroit is something that's about to happen there.
Detroit's got a lot of good stuff going there too, and they're just offering. I mean, because you know, and I feel like it's. Maybe, you know, I wonder if D.C. has this or in D.C. area as well, but, like, you're seeing a city that needs these restaurateurs and offering incentives, where New York is, like, there's no incentive for opening a restaurant.
No, it's difficult. I think that not to sound negative, or I have nothing against all my contemporaries, but I think there may be too many restaurants in New York City. So, I mean, look, if 20% of them closed, it wouldn't be a happy story, but if the silver lining is that the talent pool isn't so diluted, and hell, choice for diners isn't so diluted, it might not be a bad thing. And I'm not saying I'm not trying to paint a picture of the zombie apocalypse of restaurants that's about to happen. no one knows what's going to happen.
I mean, not to be gauche about it, but like at some point though, this is a business, right?
Yeah. So at every point it's a business. At every point.
Every point it's a business. But I ask that in the sense of like when you're saying, are we going to charge $16 or $17 for tacos? Are we going to charge $14 or $15 for ramen? Like, at what point do you say, the decision I've made to raise my prices a little bit is for profit and not just to keep the doors open?
There could be that, too. There could be people... I mean, we don't have access to people's P&Ls or their numbers. That's all private, and that's their choice. And if people want to raise their prices to make more money and simply put it in their pocket, it is a business, and there is nothing morally wrong with that. It's just a matter of if they can get it. For me to handle the minimum wage hike this year, I had to make margaritas $14 instead of $12. And if that cited a revolt, well, that was a risk I decided I had to take. I just couldn't take that extra revenue loss on the chin. And that was to net out the same. Still be profitable, but not profit more. That was to net out the same.
That's just so you can cover your costs. What about...
I mean, if you don't show a profit, you won't get an investor. If you can't get an investor... You can't get another restaurant, or you can't move forward at all. You can't get money from the bank. You can't sell your business, And so, ultimately, you do these things because you have a passion for it. And then in the end, you're responsible for all the people that work for you and their livelihood, and not just your livelihood, but also the investors that gave you their money. And you want to do it with some sense of integrity, because if it does close, you know, say it closes, that you can. You'll be able to figure out what your next step is. And that's just, in the end, with all of these things that we are discussing, you know, it's something that we had talked when we pre-prepped is like, who are going to be these restaurant investors. And, you know, restaurants are already classically considered these really insanely risky investments.
Like, what, like 90% failure?
Yeah, or what, you know, and that's mostly because 90% of them were terrible ideas. you know, it's like you can do these online Reddit funds and make a ton of money and never invest in a restaurant and all these other things that just have better rate of returns. And so, you know, there's a small group, at least in D.C. and probably in New York, where it's a small group of guys that have been successful in investing in a few restaurants, and they're the ones that are going to continue to invest in restaurants because they've been successful on the first few that they've done. And that really kind of limits your pool of where you're going to get this money from. And then when you do get the money and you're getting like $16,000 from your aunt and $16,000 from your law school friend, and these guys have a lot of hand-holding, and, you know, at some point in time, they may never get their money back. That's kind of, you know.
So let's say that I'm a young chef, I'm getting started, and I want to go down the same route that you do, which is taking this, you know, well-known ethnic cuisine that might be considered cheap, but elevating it. I mean, what's the advice that you offer? Is it go all in on brick and mortar, start off as a food court, you know, get a stand at Smorgasburg? You know, how do you get started when you're knowing that you're going to commit to something that people might perceive, you know, and say it's just too expensive?
The only advice I can give is that if you feel like with your, let's say in theory that you're making, I don't know what you're making, but let's just say yours is 20.
Let's say we do an elevated chicken wing. Like, I'm going to charge you $10 for two chicken wings.
I think that I would suggest to any chef to not only, I think chefs generally when they're opening a new restaurant, I certainly did this, all they think about is the food in the kitchen and whether their setup is nice. That's what they're worried about.
Mm-hmm.
My advice 5 years later is that don't just regard or consider the picture, also heavily consider the frame, meaning the environment that that food is in. Because if your environment sucks and you feel like with your more expensive chicken wing has to come a soliloquy on why it's more expensive, I think you're kind of screwed. I think you're, you know what I mean? Where it's like, if you, like, how do I say it? If you saw an awesome concert,
mm-hmm.
That's it. You win, and it's awesome. And you might be a musical genius that knows all the time, crazy time signatures that band was trying to hit, and they hit them. Or you're a moron who doesn't know anything about music. Not a moron, but you just don't know anything about music. And but you just enjoyed the hell out of it. But one way or another, you had a great experience. If the attitude is like, well, here's my product, and it's more expensive, and you thought it sucked, and well, then you just don't get it. You just don't get it. That the chef taking that attitude. I think not even in the long term, in the short term, you're going to be in trouble.
So, do you wish you could explain that 12 to 14 hike on the margarita? You know, do you wish there was a mechanism for you to explain that?
No, because in it, to me, that's wishy-washy, and it's sounding like it's apologetic. And like back to all of this, they are businesses. This is not this is not charity.
Right.
We are all doing whatever we are doing to hopefully make money. Is it incredibly hard in restaurants? Yes. Do most of them fail? 100%. But whose shoulder am I going to cry on, and who cares? No one asked me to do this.
Yeah.
No one told me to do this. I could have went to business school. I could have, you know, like slayed it out in a hedge fund if my finite goal is to make a ton of money. So there's a ton of risk in it, and you have to explain it. But again, it's like, rather than explain, well, why my margarita is $14, there's a reason why. But unrelated, I go, well, shit, I better have a room that makes people want to be in it to drink a $14 margarita. Or I better put that in a glass that feels $14.
Yeah, right?
Or the hospitality with it, that comes with it better match that. It better make it worth it somehow, some way. I think that's how you have to think about it.
I mean, do either of you get tired of having to explain and to justify? I mean, do you feel that sometimes like the conversation deals, and I know, ironically, I'm asking this on a panel and podcast called About the Real Price of Food, but, like, I'm tired about talking about the money of these things.
I think, like,
because some chefs never, I mean, like, Del Posto never gets questioned about it, like, I get it, but, like, there's some stuff, like, are you just, like, just, I just want to cook my food, I want you to call me and talk to me about the spice mix and not the price of what I'm serving.
I think, like, we do less of that. We really don't. There's very small percentage of time that we have to have those types of conversations with customers. And typically, it's going to be about what we first talked about when we opened the podcast, which is, why is my taco $4, right? But less of, like, you know, in this degree. But you have, I think you have a lot, at least me, because I interact with our investors a lot, you have a lot more of those now than I did, you know, when we first opened Tokyo Underground, about why are the, you know, why are our margins the way that our margins are. And it seems like every month there's another thing that you need to figure out. And, you know, when you first, you know, open a restaurant, you set one price. And when you want to change the prices, you know, you can't do it every month, every 6 months, every 8 months, and to adjust for the law. You know, you're kind of waiting like 6 months, maybe to a year before you do these major changes, or a whole nother season. So there could be months where you have these really awful margins because of a change, and you're not really, you can't just, they can't just put in a law and then you're immediately adjusting your prices. You know, you're trying to keep up with tax law changes, payroll law changes, IRS changes, HR changes, all these changes. And then the only way that we can do it is by adjusting our prices or lowering our costs. And like,
sure.
People like, you know, Chef and I, we're not going to lower our costs by buying cheaper food, different quality food. We're still sourcing for those best ingredients to give that best experience, because we're justifying a $4 taco, $15 ramen, and then dealing with not just these ethnic barriers, but all these other barriers as well.
Do you feel the pressure to make the... I mean, obviously any chef is going to want to put up good food, but do you feel that added pressure because of the conversations? I mean, of having to justify the costs and what, and the all the issues that come with it. Like, consistently, like, you can never put up bad food, and not saying that you would, but do you feel like an extra value that if someone doesn't come in and doesn't quite understand what it is that you're doing, that they feel that they're justified in saying, like, this was overpriced?
I mean, well, just for the record, they are justified in saying whatever they want as a customer.
Of course.
And they are perfectly welcome also to take their business elsewhere. As a business owner, you just have to, I think you have to read all the data and really just make a decision. And there's no right or wrong, but you have to go with your gut and make a decision on what you're going to listen to and what you're not going to listen to. Again, back to, I read two Yelp reviews today. One of them I completely disregard, and I'll tell you what they said. They said, I can't believe I paid $10 for this, and I ordered chorizo, and it wasn't real chorizo. So all that told me is that they don't really know what Mexican chorizo is.
Right.
And
I would love to know what their definition...
But that's why I disregarded that Yelp review. I'll tell you another one I read, though, right next to it that I'm pissed off about, because I think that person was right. They said, you know, I went there, and, you know, the cashier was eating guacamole, and they were too busy doing that to ring up my order. Now, that one pissed me off. I think that happened, and I think that person's telling the truth. And that's something I don't abide by. So, like, I read those things to, like, look, you have three restaurants, and you travel. You can't be in your restaurants at all times.
Sure.
But I can read that, and I can not blow smoke up my own ass and take that serious and go, we screwed up.
Yeah.
So, I think, again, like, the customer gets to say whatever they want, and we get to do whatever we want with that information. And again, yeah, sure, there's issues. Another thing I want to, like, really, to the point of ethnic cooking, quote-unquote ethnic cooking, if you opened a business with one of the core intentions is to change perception of a cuisine, you have to be you have to put on your big boy pants or your big girl pants, and you have to be willing to know that that is going to be a really, that could possibly be really tough.
Yeah.
So, of course, you can cop out and say, yeah, well, pasta is, you know, so cheap to make and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, let's talk about what was Italian food in America 40 years ago? You couldn't find Parmesan cheese wherever you looked.
Right.
No, people didn't have opinions on risotto or whether it should be made out of this rice or that rice. That didn't exist. So, I mean, you have to think about that. There were probably a lot of restaurants fighting that out and trying to, you know, bring the cuisine that they love, that they're passionate about, to this market. And probably a lot of them failed trying to pioneer that, you know. So if you're doing that, you have to be willing to take that risk. If you're just going to be a cold-blooded business person, well, just look at Italian cooking and the positive physical qualities of it and how you're going to, you know, profit off of that.
Right, and just you take some sort of quote-unquote version of Italian food.
Sure.
Make as the biggest margin you can based on ingredients and slap a nice label on it.
Sure, and there again, there's no morale. There's nothing morally wrong with that either, if that's what you wanted to do.
Well, then, I love the passion. I love of saying, like, the customer is right to think that way. But if the customer is right to think that way, again, ironically, I ask, why is there so many conversations about this? Is it just because people just have nothing better to talk about, or is it just that they want to be you know, the people have time to be naysayer, like to go do something, like it, but then be like, then complain about it anyway.
Look, I
get that. I get that every day. You know? But that's, I mean, just...
Is that just being in the public?
Our community, of people are just haters. Whether they're having a great time or not, it's just like part of our speak to be like, this, mom makes it better, grandma makes it better, this is better, this was better there. But it doesn't mean they're like not enjoying themselves or this, but also it can kind of borderline on that, you know? And I did an event in Taiwan and we had a press session like this, and I was so excited to be cooking in my home country, doing the food the way that we do it in America in my home country. And all they really cared about was whether or not I knew what it was that I was doing culturally. Mm. You know, they're like, do you know where that dish is from? Do you understand what province is that's from? Do you know who technically is the originator of this thing you're doing a riff on? No question was like, what's Toki Underground? What's Makedo? You know, this or
not,
that.
It was what's more, your life work? No, it was just
like, do you understand the nuances of why you chose to do those things? And that was, it was like that for an hour. And it was like a beauty pageant of knowledge of Chinese cooking. And it was just like, you know, and I think that's just kind of, you can ask him any question about Mexican food and he'll give you the right answer every time. And that's why we can do what we do, because we're not just, you know, cooking this thing that we are, but we're students and we want to represent it the right way.
Do you feel that, and you feel that, I mean, you must, do you feel that extra weight on your shoulder to know the province, to know the history more than someone that would be there or be from there?
I didn't before until then.
But why?
Because I didn't realize it was important to them, to Taiwanese people in Taiwan. Because they're it's a small island, so they're like, hey, here's this guy who's representing us in the U.S. There's not a lot of Taiwanese restaurants doing this new thing, and I'm just like happy to say, hey, I'm Taiwanese and you my people, you know. But then it was like, I realized from that trip, it was like to them. They were basically telling me it is important to us here, even though you're doing your own version, for you to understand where all these things came from. And then that was a big lesson for me.
And you answer those questions all the time, though, Alex, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not to get too off subject, but I think it's generally whether you are trying to cook authentic XYZ or interpretive XYZ, I think it's very important to cite the source. I think it's actually particularly important in my shoes as an outsider to it. I think you cite the source, and I think you never, ever claim, well, this is exactly how they do it in Oaxaca. You're informed by how they do it in Oaxaca. And I have cooked highly interpretive Oaxacan food in Oaxaca to see how it went. It's like, well, if here's your traditional lamb barbacoa, well, here's lamb tartare that has lamb barbacoa flavors. And I've actually gotten... really great reception to that. I think what matters is that how you roll, like how you present yourself. So if you say like, look, I'm an outsider. I think you look, I'm a white guy from Massachusetts that was brought up with undelicious food. And I think that this is the most delicious food on earth. Thank you for making it.
Yeah.
And by the way, here's my take on it as an American. This is what inspired me to do this. And so long as you present it that way, I think it's okay. To the original question, though, like again with all this commentary from people, I think another thing we have to acknowledge is that food has become a massive personal identifier for our culture.
100%.
More so, I feel like we're talking more about food now than we're talking about art or architecture or fashion or music.
Yeah.
So to that point, you are going to hear more opinions, whether those are positive ones or negative ones. It's up for grabs, but you're going to hear more of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think about that, I'd spend $9.99 a month to get a million CDs on Spotify, and that's sort of how I define the investment I make on music, you know, except for going to shows. I'll spend that on breakfast, you know? Like, I mean, that's an investment. Like, where I spend my money, and you see people like that because... You know, going back to like what it is to eat at your restaurants, I mean, you're paying for an experience. You know, you're paying for, and that's, listen, your tacos, your ramen is going to be delicious whether I eat it you know, in my couch, in my athletic shorts versus getting dressed up and going out with my fiance to a night to, you know, to the restaurant. But I know what I'm going to remember. You know, I'm not going to know that. And part of it is this thing. And I guess you guys are sort of like curators and makers of like a night out. You know, it's like you work, you know, especially younger people who are willing to like, I'm going to save. And I'm going to go to your restaurant. So as, I mean, going beyond just like the weight of the glass, the heft of the glass, something like that, like how are you guys curating the night out to go beyond just like the physical nature of it? Like, how do you create that vibe that justifies the price of what you're charging? Or not justifies, but adds to the experience.
I think you have to look at the environment holistically. That's your music or the lack thereof. It's the size of the table. It's the lighting that shines on it. It's the space between the tables. It's selecting the plate where, like, if you have a restaurant where everything is meant to share and you're going to bomb that table with six plates at once, that is perfectly okay so long as all six of those plates, plus the two share plates for the people and the forks and the knives and the water glass and their cocktail glass all fit on it. That's so yeah. People don't get pissed off about, oh, it's small plates for sharing. They get pissed off when the server tries to put the food down and you're still eating something, but they have to take that plate away to put the other plate down, and there's still not enough real estate.
And you're just so, like, this was not thought out. I'm pissed.
And again, so, but what you, and you will get someone who says, well, this restaurant sucks and it was too expensive. They don't know why it sucked. Most customers are not going to trace it back to the fact that the music was too loud or the server was a jerk, or like, because you can't remember. You're 3 to 4 drinks deep after that.
Sure.
You don't remember why. You just remember you had a negative experience, and usually it manifests in a complaint as too expensive for what it was. But maybe if you considered your plateware a little bit more carefully, or any other of the million things that make up a restaurant. This is why restaurants are exciting too, by the way, because this is the joy of a restaurateur. You're building this. This ecosystem.
Mm.
It's really cool.
Yeah,
And it's like theater. You have to execute it over and over every single night. And that's the same as whether it's a burger place or you know, a 3 Michelin star restaurant. And the other thing too is like, I want to like bring something up. Like, let's just talk about branding and the power of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just about ethnic food. A burger at Shake Shack is more expensive than a burger at McDonald's. Here's how I'll tell you one has a good brand and one has the other. One eats a burger and they Instagram it and they put the burger next to their face and they go, look what I'm eating. Look how awesome this is. I got this. And we're talking about a burger. The other one, when they eat it, they don't tell anyone and they're so freaking ashamed that they're there.
I'll tell them
They're so guilty.
I fucking ate that McDonald's burger.
Golden Arches.
It's like engaging in like prostitution or something like that. It's like you want no receipt, no evidence
McDonald's,
that this
you'll
transaction
never meet my
ever
friends,
happened.
You'll never meet my family. Instagram, I love you.
You should see McDonald's in Paris. It's really nice.
Is the quality? I mean, to go like that, like what's the? I don't know as well, but like the quality of meat for Shake Shack is a better quality than a McDonald's burger.
It's about packaging and like saying, you know, say for like Makeddo, there is nothing unintentional about the way we package this business because it's complicated. It's a menswear store. It's a coffee shop. It's an Asian restaurant. It's in black and white, and it looks like it's in L.A., but you're in this swamp of Washington, D.C. So it's like, how do we do this thing? And we modeled this restaurant off of all the really well-done retail brands like Supreme, Undefeated, Comme des Garçons. And it's like, let's make our restaurant website look like a retail brand's website. Let's run the Instagram like a retail brand Instagram. Let's make people want to come to this place just because it looks good on the internet. And that's why people buy. So like, people will be able to have a Makeddo experience when the online our online store launches next week. And we wanted to do that after we hit like 15, 20,000 followers on Instagram.
Right.
Because people will now be able to have a Makeddo experience without ever going to Makeddo.
Yeah.
Which is new, you know? Like, yeah, because Makeddo is so many things besides just the restaurant. The restaurant is just a component of that. And that's one thing that we have to do to survive. That's one way we can stay in business. And because we play this nuance of it, I think that's kind of the ground that we're breaking, is that people can have quote-unquote this experience of Makeddo without ever going there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, it's like a band. You got the t-shirts, you got the pins, you know, the CD, the live album, things like that. So I know we're getting close to the end. I just want to ask you guys, where do you see this all going? I mean, do you just see that a few brave guys like yourself are going to continue to fight this, or is it going to be more people just saying, we're going to rise this, you know, use a tide to lift all the ships, and we're just going to do better ingredients, and it's just all going to cost more?
I think there's going to be less restaurants, but they're going to be better.
Sure.
I think that with changing concepts of luxury generationally, you're going to see more new and interesting ways that really great stuff gets deployed, delivered, and packaged. And I don't think any of that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you have guys like us telling average Joe what we think is luxury now, you know, and because we're kind of defining what something really nice is, redefining what people consider luxury. And I agree, there'll be less restaurants, but they'll be better. I don't know how I would have ever opened up Toki Underground in this year, this time and age. And, you know, it's all about community building, which is probably not as possible in New York City because it's more cutthroat, but definitely more possible in Washington, D.C., where other restaurateurs help up-and-coming guys open restaurants but have nothing to do with them. I basically opened Sally's middle name, but it's not in my portfolio. You know, I negotiated the lease for them. I did everything I could possibly do for them, for him to open a restaurant and have a good deal, and then just say, hey, good luck, call me if you need any help, but this is the best possible lease you would have gotten because I was involved in it. And I think you get a lot, if you can have a lot more of those types of things happening, you'll be able to see more creative things. But if we just continue to grow and we're like, all right, this I'm cashing in and good luck, you know. Like Jose Andres was a huge help to me when I was getting Maketo going, and he invited me over to his office a lot and was like, these are the things you need to look out for as you grow, and if as long as we continue to mentor new guys, you know, we'll find ways to make things possible. People will keep making music whether or not people are buying it, and people will keep cooking food, and you know, 5 years later, everyone's buying vinyl records, you know, and it's like...
It swing backs.
Yeah, mean, it's like, who would have thought, so...
Yeah. Well, listen, guys, I want to thank you. Where can people stalk you, find you, send you love letters, hate mail?
I'll be at Empelion for... No, I'm just joking.
I'm usually at one of my restaurants one way or another. I mean, when I'm not hanging out in Austin, of course.
And online, where can they find you?
It's empellon.com, E-M-P-E-L-L-O-N.
Cool. Instagram, you got a good game?
It's Alex Stupak at both at Instagram and Twitter.
Mostly tacos and cats, right?
Mm-hmm. Satan, a lot of pictures, like, yeah.
Tacos and cats.
Tacos, I mean, that's...
Tacos, cats, and Satan.
That's pretty much the internet. As far interest. As I'm concerned, those are the three things that make up the internet, so...
I'm always at work, unless I'm here. That's always my answer to someone. Where can I find you? I'm always at work unless I'm here.
I'm right here. And online?
And online, Maketo 1351, at of course, at Toki Underground, and then at Eric Bruneryang.
Online what? Store soon?
Online store Friday.
Wow.
Awesome.
There you go. Well, thank you, everybody, who has been listening and will be listening in the future. If you enjoyed this panel, all of our South Bites coverage is on the Snacky Tunes podcast on Heritage Radio Network. And, of course, you can subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Thank you to everybody who participated in these panels and everybody who helped put them together. That's it.
Yep.
Thanks.
Shout out to Greg, to Anna, Meatball, Mom, Dad.
Yeah.
See you back in Brooklyn and L.A.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.